I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today, my guests are John Dunning and Lori Lynn Drummond. First up is John Dunning. John has owned the old Algonquin bookstore in Denver for many years. He's an expert on rare and collectible books and on American radio history. His most recent books include 2 o'clock, Eastern Wartime, Book to Die, and The Bookman's Wake. His most recent book is The Bookman's Promise, published by Scribner. Hi, John.
Hey.
Great to talk to you.
Well, nice to talk to you.
You know, prior to you being here today, I've been sort of following your path with this book. And it seems like you're getting just some real interesting and good promo. And it's such a fascinating premise, pulling in antique and collectible books into a mystery series. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, it was almost an accident. I'll tell you, it was almost fate in a way, because so much of this business is, though, you know. I mean, I had hit a stone wall in my writing career, so to speak. I had never kind of broken through. I'd written 5 books. None of them ever made anything in any way. And I went home one day and told my wife, I said, maybe it's time we did something else. We meaning me. And so we pooled our money, mostly the money that she had made in the Foreign Service, and we opened a bookstore. And that became the 8 years later, when I started to write again, that became the raw material for Book to Die, which really kind of was my, I don't know what to say, watershed book.
Huh. So 8 years you didn't write?
I may have tinkered around, but when I started back again, I was really rusty. I really had begun to give up on the business, because my agent would send these things out, and we would get these same kind of answers over and over, and it was really depressing. And I had always counted myself among those who have a fairly high heart. I know it's tough. I know the business is tough. But I had been in it most of my life then, and had never done much of anything with it. And at that point, I just really needed to get away from it.
So when you came back to writing, how did Cliff Janeway come about?
Well, Janeway is a combination of my attitudes, and I was a police reporter for a while at the Denver Post. I was a Post reporter back in the 60s and early 70s, and Janeway is a combination of my attitudes and a number of cops that I knew. I traveled around with the cops on Saturday nights. I saw some stuff that was really not very pleasant. They have a very tough job, and Janeway rose up and became what he is after I had dug at the character for about a year. And I wasn't getting anywhere. And I, you know, when a writer, at least this writer, when he's going wrong, you have this sour feeling down in your gut. You know, it's like, oh, I'm never going to pull this off. It's just, there's something wrong. I don't know what it is. I just can't. And then one day I woke up, and I can clearly remember this day. I said, I got to kick this guy in the butt. I got to make him rise up on the page, breathe fire, and take over this book. And 4 months later, I had the book done.
Interesting.
The character took over the book.
Hmm. That's always interesting when authors say that happens. I find that really interesting. You know, authors will say, I dreamed the character, I woke up, I knew what to do. What do you think, what's that all about? Is it your subconscious just working wonders?
I absolutely believe in the subconscious. Now I sink down into despair. I come up, my wife is sitting there minding her own business, and I dump it all on her. I come into her room and I say, I'm writing a lousy book. This thing is never going to work. And she's been through this before. We've been together a long time. And she kind of figuratively pats me on the head and says, now it's going to be all right. And I say, no, I'm not having any of this. I'm telling you, I'm writing a bad book. And then I go to bed, and I wake up the next morning, and something has happened in the subconscious. You get up, and the problem that you had that seems so insurmountable is suddenly you have a different slant on it. And if you do that often enough, you get through the book, you know?
Interesting. So, well, before we go on, let me say once again that I'm speaking with John Dunning, author of The Bookman's Promise, a Cliff Janeway novel. So you had all this information, all this knowledge about book collecting, and what led you into making it a mystery, throwing all that information that you have into a mystery as opposed to, say, oh, I don't know, a literary novel, a biography, a number of other things? Were you a mystery reader?
I was a mystery reader when I was young. I started with the Hardy Boys, and my first novel was a mystery. My second and third novels were mysteries, sort of. I wrote a big mainstream novel in the around 1980 that was published, and it was about the takeover of the Denver government by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. And that kind of thing is just ripe for fiction, because you've got a bunch of supremacist morons who are out there taking, you know, the mayor was in it, the governor, all of the government was Klan owned. Anyway, that's a long ago book, but the mystery thing has always been part of my, you know, it's what I got into. And so that's what I, but the thing with Burton, Richard Burton, is that I looked at him as a character, and he was 100 years ago, and to try and make a mystery out of that, we're talking about a cold case.
Yes.
So I had to reach way out there and pull in something that to make it relevant to today. That was the big problem.
That's interesting. Will you read to us?
Sure. You know, this book is about Richard Francis Burton, the explorer.
Yes.
Not the one who was married to Elizabeth
right.
Taylor. And I got a couple of pages here about Burton that basically it's fact, but it's run through my own system. And it goes like this. To a bookman, a good bibliography is far better than any, quote, life pieced together by even a diligent scholar like Fawn Brody. The subject is revealed through his own books and not through the eyes of a third party. Burton had been unfortunate with his early biographers. Long before Brody made him respectable in 1967, he had been presented as a scoundrel, and sometimes, because of his frankness in translating the sexual classics of the East, as a pornographer. He was luckier with his bibliographer. Norman Penzer was a fierce Burton advocate. His 1923 bibliography contained superb scholarship on Burton's books, and Penzer added pages of color on Burton's character, unusual in such a work. Penzer considered Burton the greatest man of his century, but a tragic man who could not suffer fools and was damned for all but his greatest accomplishments. Knighted near the end of his life in an empty gesture, he was treated shabbily by his government. He lived in the wrong time, said Penzer. His queen should have been Elizabeth rather than Victoria. Burton's story is a grand one and the most sweeping tradition of the book world. He was a Renaissance man long before the term came into popular use. Master of 29 languages, perfecter of dialects, great explorer, student of anthropology, botanist, author of 30 books, and in his later years, translator of the Arabian Nights in 16 volumes of the Kama Sutra and other forbidden Oriental classics. He was an excellent swordsman, a man of great physical and mental strength. He would need it all for the hardships he would face in unknown deserts and jungles around the world. His knowledge of human nature was vast, his powers of observation both panoramic and exhaustive, his memory encyclopedic. Wherever he went, he saw and noted everything, so that he was able to produce, almost immediately after a whirlwind trip across the American desert to Utah and California in 1860, a dense 700-page work describing the flora and the fauna, the people, the customs, and the land, and follow this 2 years later with a book of advice to the prairie traveler. His observations on the American Indian, with a long description on the practice of scalping, are classic in travel writing. Penzer believed Burton stood with the greatest explorers of all times. Compared with Burton, he said, Stanley traveled like a king. Burton's expeditions into unknown Africa would read like a myth, except for the prodigious mass of detail he recorded about everything he saw there. These accomplishments alone would make him a giant of British folklore, but he was also one of the two or three most proficient linguists of whom we have authentic and genuine historical records. He taught himself and was fluent in Arabic, Hindustani, Swahili, and Somali. He spoke Persian and Turkish, Spanish, Portuguese, and Greek. Of course, he knew Latin. Wherever he went, he soaked up languages, often perfecting dialects in a few weeks. And, Penzer reminded, he was a master of ethnic disguise. That's how he was able to go among the natives as one of them, risking his life to breach the ancient holy cities of Mecca, Medina, and Harar. He wrote of his travels in the Congo, Zanzibar, Syria, Iceland, India, and Brazil. He wrote books on bayonets, swords, and falconry. He was one of those brilliant swashbuckling wizards who comes along rarely, who understands life and writes exactly what he sees without pandering to rules of propriety or knuckling under to religious tyranny. His kind does not have an easy life. He is resented and shunned by churches and genteel society. If he's lucky, he may escape being burned at the stake. In Burton's case, he was victimized after death by his pious, narrow-minded Roman Catholic wife. Lady Isabel torched his work, burning 40 years of unpublished manuscripts, journals, and notes in her mindless determination to purify his image. That is what I call the oatmeal. That is the grit of the book. That's the kind of stuff you have to work in, often in pieces. And then my character, Janeway, comes back in his own voice, just to make sure that everyone is offended and says, this is why I am not religious. If and when we do learn the true secret of the universe, some kind of religion will be there to hide it, to cover it up, to persecute and shred, to burn and destroy. They stay in business by keeping us in the dark ages. Darkness is what they sell.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you just tuned in, you were listening to John Dunning read from The Bookman's Promise. It's a Cliff Janeway novel. I just think it's so interesting that you bring all of this knowledge about book collecting into your work. I love old books, and I'm often befuddled about why new releases sometimes seem to be more collectible than old ones. I think I went into a library bookstore the other week and found a first edition of a Saul Bellow book, Henderson the Rain King,
mm-hmm.
for I think $2.
Mm-hmm.
And I just couldn't believe what I had because I love the book, but apparently it had been sitting there a while, whereas a new book might go out the door.
It was a first?
I believe it is a first.
Well, that's Viking, I believe, right?
Yes.
And all it says on it is first published in the date by Viking Press.
Yeah.
And it's got a dust jacket?
No dust jacket.
Oh, dear.
Bad thing.
Well, you know, with modern books, the dust jacket is 90% of the value of the book.
Why is that?
Because it's been described as the soul of the book. It's the most colorful part of it, and it's the part that's the most fragile. It's the most likely to be missing. That's Henderson the Rain King is, I don't know what it is now. I haven't had one in a while, but I imagine it's a $100 book.
Mm-hmm.
But without the dust jacket, most of the value goes up in smoke, you know.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, I know people who throw the dust jackets away because they like the look of, you know, books do look a bit more vintage and classic without dust jackets.
Maybe the old ones might, but the new ones just look like every other book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. All in the dust jacket. Well, what about new books? Why does, you know, a new release, say, by a new author sometimes turn into a collectible fairly soon, even before it starts hitting bestseller lists?
Well, I had that happen to my own book.
Interesting.
Book to Die is now up around $700 or $800. And what happens is that their book is published and the tom-toms begin to spread rumors that this is going to be and then suddenly there is a heat on the book, and if it's a book with a small printing, it disappears, and people start hoarding them, and they start selling them for ridiculous amounts of money. And then you look at it 5 years later, and you find out that there were more of them printed than you thought there were. See, the whole business is supply and demand.
Yes.
If you've got a big demand and a small supply, then you will have a flooding of the market. That's what happened with Cold Mountain. It came out and there were people asking $200-$300 for it, and then there's 20,000 first editions began to flood the market, and now it's hard to sell.
Interesting.
That.
Huh? That's depressing.
It's depressing if you spend a lot of money.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, now with what you know about covers, how about your own cover? Did you have a lot of input in it? Because it is quite nice, quite appealing.
On the Bookman's Promise.
Yeah.
They send me an illustration, and usually I just say, you know, I love it. I try to go with the production people. They know their job better than I do, but I've been lucky at Scribner because I love Book That Dies cover, and I love this one.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but you must also be looking at it with sort of the collector's eye, too, in terms of, you know, how appealing is this cover in the long run, and are you thinking all those things, or are you just, when it's your own work, you're not thinking those things?
Actually, what you think when it's your book is this going to sell to the public?
Yes.
Bookman's Promise, there was 49,000 first edition, so it's never going to be the collectible that Book to Die was.
How many were printed of Book to Die?
6,500.
Uh-huh.
And they were all gone on the first day. I almost didn't get any myself. I had to scrounge all over Denver and pick them up in the chain stores and wherever I could find one that had not been scarfed up by some book scout somewhere, you know.
So will you look on, say, Amazon or other online spots for your book and see what's going on with it? And does it bother you if people are selling it for a lot of money?
Oh, well, listen, I'm flattered. I mean, you just can't tell what a big rush that is, that they value your book that way. I mean, these are all called hyper-modern books, and there's no telling what's going to happen to them in the future. See, the thing with Richard Burton, his books are established. With books like Saul Bellow's, even his earliest book, are established classics of their kind, or at least they're becoming that. Books like Catcher in the Rye, you know, Catch-22, now that Heller is dead. I saw one of those on the trip. Somebody brought it in, a signed Catch-22, and those are very scarce books now. But a lot of these hyper-modern books are just, you put the emphasis on the hype.
Yeah. Interesting. Again, you're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm speaking with John Dunning, author of The Bookman's Promise, published by Scribner. Getting back to actually writing, now, with The Bookman's Promise and your other books as well, Book to Die, before you're writing, are you really kind of sketching it out, doing a plot, doing an outline, and knowing what's going to happen, or are you discovering along the way?
I do the latter. Early in my life, I did outline books, and I wrote the book that was in the outline. But now, I know Janeway so well, I just set him down and let him walk, and then I follow him and see what's going to happen. And occasionally, he takes a wrong turn, and I have to do what I call drop back and punt. You just drop back to where you last felt the heat on the book, and you just bring it up to that point, and you go again. And often at that point, the book will take a turn and go in a different direction. The only thing you can't do is quit. You have to keep going until you get to the end of it, and then everything else gets revised to fit the ending.
So you're not worrying a whole lot as you're writing a first draft about the outcome?
Oh, I'm worried about everything. I'm a worrier. I worry about whether, you know, anybody's going to like this thing, whether it's going to be a turkey, you know, and the woman upstairs keeps me straight. When I take it up to her, she says it's going to be fine, and then when it's done and I can't actually physically take the manuscript and destroy it, then she starts telling me, now this is a little less than fine right here, you know, you could, you might want to consider doing thus and so. So she gets the first shot at it, and then it goes from there to my agent, and then she has a shot at it. She's been my agent for as long as my wife has been my wife, and she's not bashful about telling me what she thinks, and then it goes to my editor at Scribner, who, you know, Steinbeck once said, a book gets gored and slashed, and all its author can do is stand and watch.
Yeah, and there's probably something to be said for being an author that is also open to input and open to your editor and open to, like you said, working with the marketing production people and just sort of being kind of nice to work with.
Yeah, I think there is. I heard Stephen King was like that when he started. I don't know what he's like now because I don't know him, but the rumor was that when he started, he just loved everybody. I mean, why wouldn't he? His career was going nuts. I mean, but I think writers make a mistake. You know, I think it's painful to listen to criticism from people when the book is in progress. It's painful anytime, but then once you're done with it, you got to listen to everybody. And I think that's the mistake Thomas Harris made with Hannibal. I think he didn't listen to anybody. I don't know if anybody dared criticize it, but I think that was a really, I don't think that was a good conclusion to that trilogy.
Yeah. No, I don't think the book did anything, did it?
Well, it made him a lot of money.
Yeah, but that was it.
But what people start to think of is that Hannibal Lecter is the main character in that series. And from the time Clarice Starling came into it in the middle of Silence of the Lambs, she took over that book.
Yes.
She was a great heroine. And he totally betrayed her in Hannibal. I mean, when you look at the ending of that book and you see what she wound up doing, I mean, there's no way she's going to crawl in with Hannibal Lecter. I mean, not that I can see.
Right. Interesting. We have a few minutes left with John Dunning, author of The Bookman's Promise. And before I go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents.
You mean they don't dislike Hannibal as much as I do?
Who knows? Maybe not. I wanted to ask you, you know, part of what I've read about this latest book, The Bookman's Promise, and you, is that you've done this incredible tour, visiting so many bookstores and bringing in books and collectible books and talking about books, and you and your wife are all over the place. Talk about that. Do you like that part of it, the touring part?
I have never done a tour like this. I don't know who has. It's been 10 years since the last Janeway book, and we just figured that I had to do something. And so we went on a coast-to-coast driving trip, and it was great. I mean, I'm not real keen on doing the publicity. Suddenly I got the hiccups, so bear with me.
That's all right.
You do it. You know, you spend all this time doing the book, and I like meeting people, but there are moments when you want to just crawl away, you know.
Interesting.
You get somebody in front of you who you know, you're signing, you got 150 people, and I'm not kidding, sometimes there are, and you're signing books, and you say, well, how would you like this sign? And they say, write me a limerick.
And what do you say to that?
I usually tell them I can't do that. I occasionally I do it. I write limericks just for the heck of it, you know. I wrote a little book called The Bookman's Limericks, and they're limericks like this one. Never mind. An intellectual one would be, the objectivist took to the jug when the communist gave her a hug. But this isn't my fault, said an angry John Galt. It just took Atlas too long to shrug. And, you know, I wrote 70 of these things, so people know I fiddle around with them. So they get up and they say, write me a limerick and use my name in it. Well, sometimes they come instantly.
Yes.
The whole five lines, and you can do that, but more often you're holding up the whole process, and I just tell them, I can't. I'm sorry, I can't.
Hmm. What about signed books? You know, just writing your name as, you know, John Dunning, or signing it to someone personally, does one or the other increase the value or decrease the value of the book?
You know, it really depends on the author. Going back to Thomas Harris again,
yeah,
he signs very little. So a signed copy of any of his books adds several times the value of the book.
Hmm.
Another one is Cormac McCarthy, who signs almost nothing. I mean, it's not that he's difficult, it's that he doesn't go around.
Yeah.
He doesn't do the touring or any of that nonsense, as he would, I'm sure, put it. But my signature is never going to be worth a whole lot, not in my lifetime, because I sign everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if somebody brings in an ex-library copy of one of my books, I'll sign it.
Yeah.
A lot of writers get upset. I think they're fooling themselves. You've got to be good to the public. And these are the people who have put you on the map, if you're on the map. And to get back to your question, there is a shifting point of view on that. Some people believe that the more you get the author to write, the better the inscription and the more valuable it is. And others believe you just want a name and a date. But let me tell you what, there are some authors like Clive Cussler, who I knew very well when he was here in Denver, who early in his career would write these very racy inscriptions. He would pick out, some woman would come up and hand him a book, and he would say, "What's your name?" And she'd say, "Darlene." And he would say, "To Darlene, remember the wonderful night we spent together? I cannot get it out of my mind." And he would go on and on. And if you get one of those, that's kind of cool.
Well, I sure appreciate you taking the time to be on this show. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And do come back with your next book.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Take care.
That was John Dunning, author of The Bookman's Promise, published by Scribner, and he spoke to us from Denver. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will have Lori Lynn Drummond. So please stay tuned. Do not turn that dial, punch that button, do anything. Just stay right there.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching and tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM and on the web at KUCI.org. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. And the opinions and views that you hear on the show are those of me and my guests and not those of the California Regents, University of California Regents. And I'm still Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We've been here since 5 o'clock. First half, we had John Dunning with us, and now we have Lori Lynn Drummond. She's author of Anything You Say Can and Will Be Held Against You. Her fiction has appeared in Story, Black Warrior Review, and Southern Review. She was a Tennessee Williams Scholar in Fiction at the Sewanee Writers Conference. She's a former police dispatcher in Ithaca, New York, a plainclothes police officer at LSU Baton Rouge, and a uniformed officer with the Baton Rouge City Police Department. She received her MFA from Louisiana State University in 1991. She's now an assistant professor of writing at St. Edward's University, and she speaks to us from Austin, Texas. And again, her book is Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You, published by HarperCollins. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Barbara.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for asking me. I'm delighted to be on.
Well, you know, your book, your book is so good, and it's gotten just such wonderful reviews by just a range of writers, from mystery authors to literary authors, and I find that really interesting, because usually it seems that mysteries or mystery short stories are really a genre separate from the literary world, and yours seems to have crossed over What do you think about that?
Well, I'm grateful. That's actually what I was, that's what I was trying to do, was write about police work in a literary way, still having the elements of mystery and the drama and tension, but approaching it from a much more literary standpoint. So I'm actually quite grateful that the reviews and people who've read the book have commented on that.
Had you always wanted to be a writer? I mean, you were in police work for such a long time, but, you know, there's so many former police officers that have become writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking of Joe Wamba, for instance, where, you know, he was working on the street and he was writing,
mm-hmm.
and getting an advanced degree. What was the case with you?
Well, I was a reader from a very early age, and when I was 11, I tried to write the sequel to Gone with the Wind, which was an utter failure. And, you know, I've kept journals since I was in high school. I wrote bad poetry, but really, I never thought of being a writer. I wanted to be an actress. I went off to college as a theater major. So writing really never occurred to me until I'd left police work and went back to school to finish my degree.
So how did you get involved in police work?
As a theater major in upstate New York, I was attending Ithaca College, and I needed a job. And there was an organization on campus called the Student Auxiliary Security Patrol. And they were paid very well, which was the reason I was interested in it. And I did that for 2 years. We worked from 7 in the evening till 3 in the morning and had walkie-talkies and keys to all the buildings on campus. And I just found I really enjoyed both access to information that the average person didn't have, and I really enjoyed the adrenaline of answering calls, helping people, being first on the scene. So I got into dispatching, police dispatching. This was in the 1977, so women on police departments were still very rare. And then I got tired of doing that and wanted to be out on the street. So I kind of fell into it.
Hmm. And then why did you leave?
Well, I left for several different reasons. I was getting burnt out. I was losing my compassion. I was probably drinking way too much, and I wanted to get transferred off the streets. And it was very hard to get transferred off the streets because we were losing a lot of veteran officers because of the political situation in Baton Rouge. So I couldn't get transferred off the streets, and then I came very close to getting hurt badly twice, again, because we were shorthanded and poor equipment, and started thinking, okay, maybe I need to just leave altogether, but I couldn't figure out what an ex-cop with a couple years theater was going to do for the rest of their life. And then I got in a really bad wreck on duty, and I was in rehab for 15 months. And I just decided that this was the sign, and my guardian angels were telling me it was time to leave. And so I left having no idea what I was going to do. I just went back to school to finish my degree. Ended up in a writing class and loved it.
Wow, what a circuitous route.
Yes, I've had interesting things placed in front of me and made some interesting choices.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Baird, and I'm here with Lori Lynn Drummond, author of Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You. I love that title.
Thank you.
I think that's a great title. Was it always the title?
No, it wasn't. Initially, the title was Under Control, Stories About Women, Guns, and Family. And my editor said, there are titles that help a book, and titles that hurt a book, and titles that don't do either. And she said, yours doesn't do either.
Yeah.
Come up with something stronger. So actually my agent and I spent several hours on the phone with her telling me to, she says, talk cop to me. We'll come up with a title. And after I got through all the four-letter words, we moved on to, you know, I just kept throwing out phrases and ideas. And when I started doing the Miranda rights, that's the second line of the Miranda rights, and I stopped and we both went, ooh, good title.
Yeah, it's great. What a great title.
And I like it because it works on a lot of different levels.
Yeah.
Both in terms of the victims in the book, what they say can be used against them, what the female cops talk about and reveal can be used against them, and then, of course, the element of the suspects and the perps.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. You know, I'm curious how these stories became stories. I mean, you experience so many incidents, and an incident doesn't become a story, but what you do with it does, and you obviously have crafted just wonderful, strong stories here. What becomes a story?
For me, there's a lot of curiosity about motivations. I'm really interested in character and people and human beings, the choices that they make. So there's one story in there, Under Control, about a man who shoots and kills his brother in front of their paralyzed father. That's actually based on a scene that I worked. And unlike the story, I had control of the gun and the situation within seconds. But that image stayed with me, the man shooting his brother in front of his paralyzed father. And the story grew out of that, my being curious as to who these people were and how it had come to that point where, you know, he had shot and killed his brother and who was the father. And then really just kind of stepping back and saying, what kind of a person would this impact answering the call? So it grows out of curiosity for me.
Do you begin stories that you end up just throwing out, or when you're into one, or is it a pretty sure bet that you're going to finish?
When I started writing, in fact, I was cleaning out files earlier today and looking at some early stories and going, I would start a lot of stories and push. I was still learning technique. These days, when I start a story, I finish it. It may take me a while. It may take me some time to figure out who this character is and why they're talking and what they're doing. But I finish what I start. So I think I've learned to become much more selective in terms of what a story is.
In terms of the story as opposed to a novel, what is it about the short story form? Are you more of a lover of short stories than you are of novels?
No, I'm actually working on a novel now.
Mm-hmm.
I read both, and I read them for different reasons. The short story can be, I think it was Poe who said, you know, a short story should be something that could be read in a single sitting. And for me, there's a beauty in entering into a story for 15 minutes or half an hour, and you get this fragment of a person's world and yet a whole sense of their history. Whereas the novel, it's much more drawn out. You read it over a series of days or weeks. And I like dancing the line between. I mean, these stories are in some ways a story cycle, in that the characters enter into each other's stories. It's all the same setting. I think that's fun to play with. But I like to read both.
Is your process much different for either?
Well, I'm flailing a lot with a novel because I've never written one before.
Uh-huh.
I'm learning a lot about pacing. For me, there's the best way I can describe it, there is a body feel to writing a story. And whether it's a 15-page story or it's an 80-page story, I know now's the time to end this scene and move on. And I may not know exactly where to move on, but that comes pretty quickly. I know when to pick up the pace. I know when to slow down. With a novel, I'm really flailing around much more, trying to find that pace. The first 100 pages were just too slow. So I'm going back and really cutting, and I think you have to know your character a lot better too.
So with the novel, have you done outlines and just character, you know, sketches and all of that, or is it a path of discovery?
It's more a path of discovery for me, although I got about 50 pages into it and got so lost with names that I had to put a sheet up above the computer and kind of draw lines. And when I got to about 100 pages, I sat down and kind of roughed out sections just so it would give me a guideline as to where I think it will go. But my guess is that there will be certain elements of story writing in that you often don't know where you're going to end up, because when you're really writing well, in other words, you're in the zone, the characters take off and do the story for you, and you're just following along on the keyboard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a process of discovery, and I've learned not to say this is where the story's going to end up.
Yeah, interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Lori Lynn Drummond, author of Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You, published by HarperCollins. Curious, because I've heard so many authors say, and literary agents that have come on the show, how difficult it is selling a collection of short stories.
Yes.
How was it for you? Because somehow I'm sensing it wasn't that bad.
I think I'm one of those once in a blue moon examples, but I have to set that in context and say first, I worked on this collection for 12 years. And I really had it in good shape, and I published some of the stories in literary journals. I feel extraordinarily lucky. There was a very good response to the short story collection from publishers. There was interest in my writing a novel. I can't believe that I got a two-book deal. It's unheard of. The kind of book tour that HarperCollins sent me on, they have been so behind this book. It's incredibly unusual in the market today to get this kind of backing. So I'm quite grateful, and I'm very aware that it's highly unusual. You know, that happens to other people. It doesn't happen to me, kind of a feeling. I feel very, very grateful.
Mm. Well, I'm totally delighted for you.
Thank you.
And I would love it if you would read to us.
I'd be glad to.
Okay.
The book is broken up into sections, five different women, and this is from Kathy's story, Something About a Scar. The first time I saw Marjorie LaSalle, she was kneeling on her bed naked, hands gripping the sheets to help support her weight, a 9-inch steak knife embedded deep just above the spot where the flesh parts to rise and become breast, the place where a child or lover would rest his head in grief, in need, in utter devotion, that place the tips of fingers caress and feel both implacable bone and sweet full softness, a place of promise, of absolution, the center of ourselves. Her house was impossibly full of men, overly loud voices, and too much artificial light for 2:52 in the morning. All those police officers, five out in the yard, three in the living room, two talking in the hallway, one taking pictures of the nightstand, another speaking into a portable radio by the walk-in closet, and not one touched her or sat by her or held a sheet to cover her. Only two paramedics hovered nearby, talking briskly and efficiently as they set up an IV and discussed how best to move her to the gurney. They eased her onto her back as I finally stepped into her bedroom, handling her body, it seemed to me, as though it were separate from her soul. There wasn't much blood, and this small detail bothers me even today. A smear on the portable phone, the sheets wet with red in places, but not drenched. When the phone rang, wrenching me out of sleep, and the flat male voice said, "We got a VS request on a stabbing and sexual assault in South Downs." I'd expected to walk into a small pond of blood. Half awake, I stumbled over my still slumbering dog and put on old stonewashed jeans and a black polo shirt with my name, Kathy, and victim services embroidered on the front, clothing that could handle cold water soaking and heavy detergent. On the short drive into South Downs, I rehearsed the victim services list of rules in my head. Do not touch anything. Do not interfere with the police officers. Do not make judgments or offer opinions. Use a soothing voice. Do not volunteer information about yourself. Do not touch the victim without asking the victim first. Do not ask what happened. Focus on active listening, compassionate support, and contacting the friends and relatives the victim wants notified. This was my first solo call out, and I still believed in the rules. As soon as I turned off Perkins Road, I knew I was close to the scene. Tail lights, spotlights, and flashing red and blue lights punctured what should have been dark, calm, sleepy. A simple middle-class neighborhood in the heart of Baton Rouge, where during daylight children rode bikes, dogs trotted aimlessly in neighbors' yards, couples bickered lightly on porches, and lawnmowers puttered every weekend. Generally a safe place, or as safe as any place can be. But now police cars lined the block, along with a fire truck and ambulance. Some neighbors stood on the edge of their driveways or in doorways, peering toward all the activity, dressed in hastily thrown on clothes and bathrobes. I felt a momentary thrill, but unlike them, I would walk into the crime scene. Unlike them, I would have access to the intimate details.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Lori Lynn Drummond reading to us from Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You, published by HarperCollins. I'm curious about, how you stay detached enough from the experiences you had as an officer and yet involved enough in the story so that it resonates for the reader. Because there's so much emotion and so much going on in your stories that you just, I don't know, it's hard to know how it is for the writer of these stories, you know, for you.
In some ways it was very traumatic, revisiting a lot of the things I'd seen and done and felt and experienced as a police officer, because I had to inhabit my characters and think that way again. So it was a very interesting process to be in character and then kind of pull myself out at the end of the day and wander around somewhat dazed in
yeah,
my house.
Sure.
Again, I could dip into those feelings for the first draft and really be with it. And then I found that as I revised, as I came back and did additional drafts, I could be much more removed. And I think that's almost the way it has to be for me as a writer, is the first draft is very hard, the creative process, to really let go and be with it and create. And I much, much prefer revision. And it may be because revisiting those emotions and that time as a police officer is really hard for me.
Yeah, I bet. Gosh, we have a few minutes left and I have so many questions for you. One is in that you teach writing. How,
I do.
How is it, being an author and being a teacher? How does teaching affect your writing?
I teach at a school where I have a very heavy course load. I teach 4 courses each semester, and they're 4 different preps. So it's actually very hard for me to do any first draft work during a semester. I do it on breaks or during the summer. When I can, I do revision. I don't like to work on my fiction while I'm teaching a fiction class, and I don't like to work on my nonfiction while I'm teaching a nonfiction class. I'm thinking and talking about technique so much as a teacher to then go home to my own work that all that talk about technique is right in front of me. And that's not good for the creative process. That's got to be behind you. So it's actually quite a challenge, to dance between those two.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what a course load.
It's kind of tough.
What about when you're on tour, just sort of skipping over to something else?
Mm-hmm.
Are you able to write when you're on tour?
Oh, no. And you know, I had thought about taking my laptop along with me, and I'm so glad I didn't. You know, when you're in a city for less than 24 hours and you're doing a lot of PR work, I found that when I had 3 or 4 hours, I wanted to be very quiet in a room all by myself, not talking to anybody,
uh-huh.
staring at the wall.
Sure. And not hearing your characters talk to you either.
Right. Well, airplane flights, that was really good to kind of let the characters talk.
Huh.
But not writing. And I did some driving while I was on tour, and that was really nice to let the characters in my novel let loose. But as far as writing, I did 26 cities in under 2 months, and it was just very intense.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing a lot of people I hadn't seen in a long time and doing a lot of interviews. And I just, the energy went that way. Maybe by the time I've done my 5th book tour, I'll have a handle on
mm-hmm.
that.
Do you enjoy touring?
I do. I had a wonderful time. It was just gratifying on a number of different levels, to have police officers show up at the reading. and to hear them say, you got it right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so officers in Salt Lake City and Los Angeles and San Francisco and Washington, D.C. are having the same experiences that my characters did in Baton Rouge. I had a lot of former students from across the country come out to the readings. It was a really, to have worked on this book for so long by myself and then get out in the world and hear the response to the book is just enormously gratifying.
Yes.
And fun.
Hmm. Yeah, I would think that might be some of the most fun parts of
mm-hmm.
publishing.
It,
you know,
it
being
really
able
to
go around and have a good time with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And go to all those different places, some of which I'd never been. So, and all the booksellers, you know, being in the different bookstores, and it was wonderful. It really was. It was exhausting, but it was wonderful.
Lori, we're almost at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening.
Read a lot, and don't give up. Keep writing. Make sure it's the best thing you can do before you send it out, whether you're sending it to magazines or to a agent. Make sure you've gone over and over and over it, and it's the best thing in your mind. And don't give up. Every once in a while, you know, we get these breaks. So I had got a lot of rejection letters before I got acceptance letters.
Hmm. That's the part that I think writers often forget about published authors, is that
mm-hmm.
there's so much rejection that you mm-hmm. undergo until mm-hmm. until it's your time.
Right. Well, and you continue to get rejections. You know, you can apply for fellowships and grants and those kinds of things, and you get turned down. So,
yeah.
That's one of the hard parts of being a writer, and you kind of have to just grit yourself against that and let the passion for the craft, apprentice yourself to the craft, and if it's, you know, important to you, you'll keep going.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara.
And
it's been fun. I've enjoyed it.
Me too, and I wish you just continued luck with this book.
Thank you so much.
You've done a wonderful thing.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was Lori Lynn Drummond, author of Anything You Say Can and Will Be Used Against You, and it's published by HarperCollins. And what else? We're at the end of our time once again. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. I didn't send one out this week, and I apologize to those of you listening who wondered what happened. I don't know what happened. It didn't go out. What can I say? If you miss getting it, write to me and scold me, and I'll be sure to do it next week. And I want to leave you with a quote by Mark Twain, who said, "Dance like no one is watching, sing like no one is listening, love like you've never been hurt, and live like it's heaven on earth." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.